Human-centered AI means that we design the tools around the human and not force a human to learn a novel modality. The EU AI Act is not regulating technology as such, but the usage of technology. I believe that many jobs will be affected by AI in the future. I don't think so much that many jobs will really disappear as in their job description. I think they will be transformed. But of course, productivity will be risen. And this also means you need less people for the same amount of work.
Welcome to the Regulating AI podcast. Join host Sanjay Puri as he explores the dynamic and developing world of artificial intelligence governance. Each episode features deep dives with global leaders at the forefront of regulating AI responsibly, tackling the challenges using AI can bring about head-on and enabling balance without hindering innovation.
Welcome to another episode of the Regulating AI podcast, where we bring together diverse voices from around the globe to discuss the future of AI regulation. Today, we have a distinguished guest with us, Professor Antonio Kruger. Professor Kruger is the CEO of the German Research Center for Artificial Intelligence, DFKI, and the head of the Cognitive Assistance Department at DFKI. He's also a full professor of computer science at Saarland University, leading the Media Technology Lab. His work sits at the fascinating intersection of artificial intelligence and human-computer interaction, focused on ensuring that AI developments are human-centered and beneficial to society. We are thrilled to have him here to share his insights on AI regulation, human-centered AI, and the future of AI applications and more. Welcome, Professor Kruger.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Wonderful. Antonio, we have a global audience of people who are policymakers, legislators, CEOs of company, enthusiasts around the world. So could you tell them a little bit about your role at the German Research Center for Artificial Intelligence and your work at the Saarland University, just to inform them?
Yeah, I'm glad to do so. So the German Research Center for Artificial Intelligence is an institution that exists for more than 30 years now. And it sits actually on the intersection of basic research and applications and the transfer of basic AI research into applications, of course, in particular with a focus on German economy, small and medium-sized enterprises, also the large companies, of course. And it is, of course, also one of the leading institutions in Germany that educates in AI. So we have lots of PhD students, lots of master and bachelor students that work with us and do their research, often in a context of companies, actually, so with company data. And I personally have a background in AI, and in human-computer interaction. And I've started more than 10 years ago at DFKI and was responsible actually to build up one of DFKI's living lab, actually a lab on future retail, which is a fascinating topic that was at that time, you know, a couple of years into the first iPhone, you know, and I've worked there for a while, and then since 2019 now I'm actually responsible for the technical and scientific strategy and direction of DFKI. DFKI now is a large institution in Germany. It has over 1,000 researchers now and is present in 7 regions, actually, not only at Saarland, in Saarland University, but also at several other universities.
Wow. So a pretty large research institution that is out there, especially given the critical nature of AI. Antonio, your research focuses on the intersection of AI and human-computer interaction. Can you explain to our audience why this intersection is important and so critical?
Yeah, I think it's a very important and very interesting, fascinating research field also, because if you think about classical human-computer interaction, so the way how you would very ergonomically use a touchscreen or a mouse and a keyboard to issue commands in a computer, we see actually a shift in the way how we interact with computers. We have more and more kind of high-level tasks that we give computers. For example, you know, if you just see the very recent development in generative AI, even in a complex natural language, you know, and the question now is, do computers exactly do what we want them to do on such an abstract level? You know, if you control a mouse, you see your pointer, you know exactly, you know, what to do and where to click and so on. But of course, if you issue abstract tasks like saying, yeah, please plan my next holidays in Italy, for example, then the question is, how can we ensure that the machine is really following our intent? How can we ensure that machines actually follow our ethical guidelines, for example? You know, how do we ensure that we know what the machine is doing, you know, and it's not kind of overriding certain important preferences that we have, for example, yeah. And what you see is actually that in the interaction with these complex systems, we move more and more from a direct control task to an oversight task. So actually, and this is a new role for us as humans, you know, in human-computer interaction. And but it's an important shift that we see now, a paradigm shift even. And the interaction paradigms are not 100% set and clear at this point. And that is actually what I'm in particular interested in.
So, Antonio, for our listeners, what does human-centered AI mean to you?
Yeah, human-centered AI means to me that as all other tools that humans have invented, you know, they're an end to they're means to an end, you know. And this end actually is human-centered. So it means we are developing AI tools that are meant to support humans actually in their task, actually to lead to better lives for humans. And this also means that in all our research efforts, you know, we have this in mind and design our system, design even our research agenda towards that goal, that these systems support humans. They are perfectly, I think this is perfectly okay also to do research without humans in mind, you know, this is perfectly okay, but that's not the kind of research that we do with AI systems. You know, we are interested in AI systems that are tools and support humans, highly complex tools, also tools that act partially autonomously. Of course, this then requires additional thoughts how to do this so that they end up still being tools, you know. But I think this is what we mean by human-centered artificial intelligence.
So, Antonio, just to follow up on your perspective, these days, I mean, for average person, the chat box is, you know, whether it's ChatGPT, Anthropic, any of those, Gemini, etc., that's their interaction. But now, lately, there have been a lot of noises, some stumbles about wearables, about, you know, the pin, the rabbit, etc. What are your thoughts on that? Because that's a paradigm shift. At least that's what people are saying. There's a paradigm shift. Now, you are a pioneer in human-centered AI. I would love to understand, what do you think is wearables, people say moving away from the computer, etc. What are your thoughts for our audience on that topic?
So I think actually that if you see the current predominant interaction paradigm, which is touch, basically, you know, so it's not keyboard and mouse anymore for quite some years, it's touch. All most of the devices that we interact with, computer devices, use a touch interface, so phones, also smartwatches, and so on, you know. And still, voice is somehow underrepresented, you know. If you compare this to human interaction, which I would say 90% is basically voice interaction, as is this discussion that we are having currently, you know, And the question is, why is this? You know, one is, of course, that speech, natural language, is very complex. It provides it's very powerful also, because it can convey very abstract concepts in a very short amount of time. You know, mm-hmm. It's very ambiguous, so there are many interpretations to it. And what's exciting actually with the newest generation of AI models is that voice as an interaction, a modality, is getting more and more useful, you know, and will be integrated into future devices for sure. Mm-hmm. The devices that you mentioned are, I would say, first attempts to do so. Mm-hmm. They might be not very successful attempts at the moment. That's actually my view. Mm-hmm. But I think they will eventually succeed, because voice is such an important modality to humans. Again, mm-hmm. to come back to human-centered AI. Human-centered AI means that we design the tools around the human and not force a human to learn novel modalities, you know, mm-hmm. Like touch is such a novel modality for human, at least when it comes to interaction with devices, you know. Mm-hmm. So that I believe that actually the current development will lead to much more voice interaction. Mm-hmm. We've seen recent developments in terms of interaction speed, turnover speeds. You know, this mm-hmm. is important improvement, because we know that if you have to wait, you know, for a system to respond to your voice commands, you know, more than, mm-hmm. Let's say, 100 milliseconds or so, then this will hinder actually the interaction. So this is good news. On the other hand, I still believe, you know, that voice is not the only modality, you know. So we still need we will still need screens, you know. We will make use of graphical information, visual information. It's so much powerful. The bandwidth is much bigger and so on. Mm-hmm. And but we are at an exciting point in time where I believe that in the next 5 to 10 years, there will be novel device concepts that rely much more on natural language than former device concepts. Yeah.
So, Antonio, to follow up, as you know, OpenAI, Google DeepMind have announced, and several others, multimodality of working with their, whether you call it chat box or whatever it is. It's, you know, voice, it's images, it's videos, etc. So the paradigm is shifting, but for normal people who are basically keying it in their phone or computers, what if you, as a pioneer in, you know, human-centered interaction, what is your vision for an ideal human-machine in partnership in AI?
So I believe that actually multimodality is the key. So we will use many modalities in the future. Mm-hmm. So not only voice, not only touch, but also other modalities, like, for example, physiological information from our body. So one mm-hmm. interesting observation, regardless of the AI models, is that computers have moved towards us. You know, they started maybe 50, mm-hmm. 60 years ago in the large mainframe computer. You know, there were own buildings built around computers. We still have those. They're in the cloud. But mm-hmm. And then they moved on our desktops, and from our desktops on our body, on our wrist, for example. Or you remember the glasses, you know, glasses mm-hmm. are also, if we think about development there, you know. And the next step, and I think this is inevitable and comes with a lot of additional challenges, but might be very beneficial, is also hardware that goes into our body to a certain extent, you know. So mm-hmm. that measures vital functions, you know. And all this will be used actually to make interaction with computers as seamless and as easy as possible. I still believe, though, that again, human-centered, you know, that actually control comes from the humans. So I believe voice will play an important role, but this voice will be the information that comes from our voice commands and from the voice dialogue with the system will be augmented with additional information that comes from other sensors, also from our body, you know. And this will make interaction much more easy, less ambiguous, and more efficient, actually.
So are you kind of alluding to things like Neuralink, where we are inserting chips in our brains and things like that, using that kind of technology, Antonio?
So I think I find this fascinating. Mm-hmm. I believe if I come back actually to my human-centered view, mm-hmm. now we enter, if you think about adding, enhancing, for example, your cognitive abilities and so on, mm-hmm. There is, of course, an ethical debate whether this would be really human-centered in a way, you know? Mm. So the question, of course, is what is human? What does human mean, you know?
Right.
And I guess different cultures have different views on this, you know? I think in Europe, we are maybe a little bit more conservative here. So people would maybe say, okay, health functions, monitoring of health functions, you know, it might be okay. But a neural link that maybe alters your cognitive abilities is maybe too much, you know. Mm. I personally would not add a neural link to my brain, you know. Mm. But of course, you know, this is a little bit also a cultural and personal preference, sure, to a certain extent. And I believe society will move forward. I don't believe that we will see many actually neural link implants, you know, in the near future, beside, of course, medical application. I think for that they are great, you know, there's no question mm-hmm. about it. But of course, who knows what happens in 40, 50 years, you know, when these kind of things, cultural interest and so on, shift over time, you know. So we'll see. It's fascinating that the research is definitely fascinating for sure.
Well, you talked about being in Europe, Europe being a little more conservative. There is a saying that some people in the U.S. say that Europe is a regulatory superpower, U.S. is an innovation superpower, etc. I want to get your opinion. The EU recently, it's gone through many stages, but on the 21st of May, it finally passed the EU AI Act. Give our audience, you are right in the center, leading a huge research institution in Germany. From what we understand, Germany and France had something to do with tweaking the laws for some reasons. But tell us your view about the EU AI Act to our listeners.
Yeah. So I personally think that it's good to think about regulation, you know. Mm-hmm. So I also welcome this podcast, your podcast, that puts this into the center of a large mm-hmm. discussion. Mm-hmm. I think it's important because regulation, on the one hand, and I understand also the concern, being an innovator myself, you know, of course, regulation always kind of has the potential to slow down innovation. Yeah, mm-hmm. But on the other hand, I think the risks also associated to AI are of such a nature that it's good to think about certain railguards, guidelines, you know, and also rules that apply mm-hmm. to the use and to the development of AI, mm-hmm. which then again also helps to provide level playing fields in a certain mm-hmm. way and give also a certain assurance to players in that field, commercial players, that they're allowed actually to benefit from their investments into a field. Mm-hmm. Because what would be catastrophic actually is that we all develop and companies invest lots of money into a piece of technology that then is completely forbidden and over-regulated. So I mm-hmm. think it's a good idea to start with these kind of regulations. I think the EU of course, as usual, it took a lot of time. You mentioned mm-hmm. several iterations, you know, many stakeholders. That's the way how it works in the EU. Sometimes this is also too slow, I have to admit. But in the end, I think it's a good compromise. We have the EU AI Act is not regulating technology as such, but the usage of technology. And I think this is not something new. You know, we have many application areas, especially in the medical domain, but also in the mobility domain, where we already have regulation of usage, and rightfully so. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And now the UAI Act does something similar for the usage of AI. We have different kind of risk classes, risk mm-hmm. categories, and depending on these risk categories, other different rules apply. You know, in the lowest risk category, basically no rules apply. Highest risk category is basically is a category where AI, the use of AI is forbidden completely, at least for civil applications. And then you have middle risk categories that require a certain amount of transparency, documentation, and so on. I think this makes sense. And the other important part is also to remain flexible in the way how you can adapt those rules. We know AI is moving fast, you know, and the framework has certain aspects that annexes and so on that can be adapted faster than the whole framework itself. I think mm-hmm. this is also a good idea. But in the end, we will see. You know, it's a little bit, of course, a risky undertaking from the European Union. My feeling is that given the large size of the EU and also the good core ideas, that this is something that others will adopt to a certain extent, also in the US, I'm pretty sure.
So just as a one aside, if you think the EU Act is slow, think about the US. We are not even close to getting any regulation. We are in a presidential election year. So that's, I'm in DC and I can tell you, slow is our middle word here. But coming to the EU AI Act, you are in Germany leading this large research institution. Is there a worry for you, a twofold things, Antonio, that it is going to inhibit companies, you know, startups or companies at all from that standpoint? That's one quick question for you.
Yeah, I think there is a risk. You know, one would be naive to say that regulation does not pose risks. You know, it's of course, there is the risk that actually investments are not made, you know, I agree. On the other hand, I believe that in particular for Europe, that has a different economic structure as, for example, the US, you know. In Europe, we have many mid-sized, small-sized enterprises that are often family-owned mm-hmm. for a couple of generations now,
right.
and that are market leaders in their niche. Yeah, mm-hmm. technological market leaders. Mm-hmm. And I think for Europe, it's important that these small companies that don't have enormous abilities to invest into AI, that they are still able to benefit from AI, that they're able to augment their products, you know, mm-hmm. with AI services, with AI technology, to be able to compete also in the next decades, you know. Mm-hmm. Because if they are not able to include AI into their product, I think this will be very hard and very difficult to still stay on top, you know. So this is important. And for them, it's these regulations at least help them to make safe investments, you know, and to now be able to say, okay, now we know how the rules are, and now we are able to invest, and we are sure that our product will have a market, you know, that they will not right. be excluded from certain markets.
So there is some level of predictability, consistency for these companies. I think that's what you're saying, which is very, very
yes.
helpful. Should the world have some level of harmonization of regulations? I mean, if you have patchwork of US having one, EU having another, China is doing its own thing, God knows, you know, African Union is working on it. I understand there is AI nationalism, and we'll touch on that a little bit, but should there be some kind of a harmonization of AI regulation?
So I'm absolutely convinced that we need a kind of international agreements, actually, mm-hmm. on how AI should be regulated. And I myself, I'm part of OECD process, mm-hmm. That looks at rules for AI. I'm mm-hmm. part of the Bleachley safety, AI safety report. This is very mm-hmm. important, actually. And mm-hmm. it's actually good news that, for example, in this AI safety report, there has been just the interim report being issued. You know, there was in Seoul now a mini summit. There will be a larger summit on AI and safety in this fall in Paris. Mm-hmm. And the good news is actually that more than 30 nations, including also China and others, you know, mm-hmm. are part actually of this initiative, you know. And I believe this is at least the starting point. You know, AI and safety, it's clear that AI has many kind of safety threats, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's good that we have an international, that the international initiatives and that hopefully lead then to international agreements, you know, mm-hmm. how to deal with those threats. Yeah, and build on that, I guess also the more general questions how to regulate AI might at least lead, so, you know, these initiatives might lead to a minimum set, you know, of internationally, globally accepted requirements for AI systems, you know. And I think this is a laudable goal to achieve, and it's important to work on this, yes.
So you are saying that there should be some consistency, Antonio, in terms of the framework for regulation. In your view, Antonio, you talked about being part of this safety institute, whether it's in UK and now in Seoul and moving to Paris. What are your biggest concerns for AI? If you were to tell our listeners, what worries you, what keeps you up at night about AI?
So actually, I think the biggest concerns are the ones that are related to the massive scale of fake information that can be distributed, you know, mm-hmm. the strong biases that can be introduced by AI systems, you know, mm-hmm. and again, those are all things that are not 100% new to us in terms of the internet is full actually of these threats in a way. But of course, modern AI models allow to scale these attacks and also scale this misinformation in a way that we haven't seen before, you know, and this is something that worries me, you know. I also believe that, again, you know, following a human-centered AI approach, it's important to me that AI is still used as a tool and not used to basically tool humans, actually, you know, and change humans. And there is a risk, actually, that as with many tools, human tools, you know, in the hand of wrong people, you know, of course, the potential actually of harm and damage is pretty high. And therefore, I'm glad that actually, for example, in this AI safety process, you know, many nations came together. And first, now we have identified the different threats, you know, associated to AI, and also we are discussing technological, but also at a certain point, of course, also regulatory means, you know, to counteract them.
So, I mean, you touched upon some key things, as you said, biases, some deep fakes, which is a big concern as we have an election in this country, and there's elections in many, many other countries. Do you have some suggestions as to so let's address the topic of deepfakes. In the US, we've talked about watermarking and some other technologies, even though they are not 100% successful. Then there is the issue, as you talked about, with biases. And then finally, Antonio, the issue is about privacy also, because of data. So when you look at some of these issues, your suggestions, ideas, thoughts on some how to tackle these very big, or when you go to these very exclusive things in Seoul or in UK, etc., What are some of the solutions being proposed for these kinds of things?
So I think there will be not one solution, actually, but we need actually a full breadth actually of different approaches. One, of course, are technological solutions. So it's, of course, it's a little bit a rat race. We know this, actually, as it has been always with cyber attacks, you know. But it is, there is a fair chance that we can use technology actually to prevent most of the damage. Yeah? Mm-hmm. So this is one thing. Watermarking, at least for images, I think, and works fine. And it will, we're already seeing it. The big tech companies basically have agreed actually to introduce watermarks in nearly all kind of images that are generated mm-hmm. through AI and so on. I think this is very useful and very helpful. Mm-hmm. It's also in their own best interest, because if you think about you don't want to train on data that has been generated by AI models, you know, at mm-hmm. least you want to know about this if you use this data, you know. Mm-hmm. So that's the question, where does the new data come from and so on, and what happens if you feed data back into AI models, you know. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing. I believe the other thing is, of course, also education. This is very important, you know. We have to educate. And the problem is, since these developments are very fast, you know, mm-hmm. and we're moving really on a very mm-hmm. dynamic field, and education usually is much slower, you know, we need to make sure actually that people understand, you know, that they understand that what AI is able to do in what scale, you know, AI is able to do it. We have to, we need regulation, because without regulation, we cannot enforce laws. You know, we don't have laws. We would need standards. I think this is very important for safe AI systems, for transparent AI systems that are able, that can be scrutinized, that can be explained. And this is important, because this will then allow to audit AI systems, you know, mm-hmm. And I envision actually at a certain point a world where we have fully audited AI systems, so we know what they're doing, and everything else is not safe, basically. You know? It's like building your own car, you know, out of your garage and going on the road. I think there might be some countries, including in the US or some areas, where this is allowed, but in Europe it's definitely not allowed, and I think it's not so good that's not allowed, you know. Mm-hmm. So something similar actually for AI systems, future AI system, is very desirable in my opinion.
So what you're suggesting, Antonio, and I want to just follow up, because I talk to a lot of these leaders, is some kind of an audit mechanism to audit some of these systems. Now, Antonio, large publicly traded companies have at least they're set up, so to speak, these audit boards or ethics boards, etc. What are your thoughts in terms of something like that? I mean, when you talk about auditing, are you talking about auditing these foundation models? Are you talking about the application of these foundation models, or the use of it, or all of it?
So, yeah, I think, first of all, I think it's good that many also AI companies have ethic boards to basically raise the awareness, actually, of the responsibility. I remember when I studied computer science in the 80s, you know, ethical concerns were never addressed actually during my studies, you know? And this has changed, fortunately, and also it's important that this has changed, you know. Computer scientists, people that work in AI, data scientists that are part of building large AI systems, have a huge responsibility nowadays, you know. And it this is something they need to be aware of. And it's good to have actually bodies within companies, but also within institutions, universities, that basically keep the awareness level very high in this respect. On the other hand, I don't think this is enough. This is my personal opinion. I believe that we also need kind of neutral auditing in a way, because companies always have, of course, a certain, and that's perfectly fine, but of course they are set out to earn money, actually, you know, and make money, and they might come into conflicts, you know, in terms of economic pressure and so on. So I believe having neutral bodies that do this auditing is also important, and we will see in the European Union such institutions will be actually installed. They are not there yet, but they will come for sure. I believe that also other countries will do this. The question now is what to audit, and the honest answer is we don't know exactly yet. So research still has to be done to understand exactly what we can audit and what should be audited. Yeah, but I believe that so we should start actually in the use cases. I think this is the easiest thing to do. I'm not so much a fan of saying we should audit now foundational models, for example, that are base technology. You know, I won't say that this will not happen at a certain point in time. But at the moment, I think it's not very useful. You know, we don't even know exactly what to look for. Yeah. So I think it's much more useful at the moment to think in terms of applications. There are sensible applications, applications that potentially can cause harm, you know, and make sure that we audit those. And I think step by step, this will maybe then also lead to a better understanding how we can audit AI technology in general. But at the moment, we are not there yet, in my opinion, to really be able to say how to do this in a sensitive manner. Yeah.
So, Antonio, to summarize, what you're saying is we need to audit. We still don't know yet what to audit, but your focus is going to be more on applications. And in the EU, there are going to be these entities that will be providing third-party audits as per the EU AI Act. And what you're saying is that's very, very important. Antonio, we've covered, you know, we talked about biases, we've talked about some of the ethical implications, etc. I've had guests from Europe, from smaller countries, not as big as Germany, etc. And some of them, well, some of the larger ones, including France, also express this. There is a worry, and I want your view, that these large language models are getting trained on English language. They are all Silicon Valley based, getting trained on the internet. Is there a worry that some of the culture, the language of smaller countries, larger countries, whether it is Finland, or some African regions, etc., that might get erased in this whole process?
Absolutely. I think this is a valid worry, and it should be addressed. You know, it's clear already now, actually, the large foundation models from, in particular, you know, from US companies, they are much better in providing answers and advice in English than, for example, in a small language like Finnish, for example, you know. And I think it's important for, and therefore there is the need for room for a variety of foundation models that have been trained and also specialized on smaller languages. We have, for example, at DFKI, we just recently finished a project where we used actually one of the open source models that from Mistral AI, which is a French-based AI company, and we retrained the model with additional data from French corpora, from German corpora, from Italian corpora, and the results improved enormously in these languages. So there is also the possibility that we take one of the existing models that are mainly, of course, trained in English, and we add data that is maybe not publicly available, for example, from EU archives, you know, or from archives from public media companies from a certain country, and achieve very comparable levels, you know, of performance in small languages. You know, I think this is very important, And we need to be very attentive, you know, to cultural issues in these foundation models. It's also one threat that's mentioned actually in the AI safety report.
Wonderful. So you are working on some of these things, because I know some of our Finnish guests have said that they are working on their language and others, which I think is very, very critical to keep the culture and the language. I think otherwise you lose a lot from history, not just for that culture, but for the rest of the world.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead, Antonio.
No. Yeah, I completely agree. And what is also important is once we have these multicultural foundational models, they will be much better. They will, if those collaborate, you know, there's this large approach on multi-agent systems now. You know, it's a very important topic in research. It turns out that if you have multiple instances of foundation models that work together on one problem, the results are better than having just one foundation model work on that problem on its own, you know. Mm-hmm. And if you extrapolate this, you know, you could expect that different foundation models with different cultural backgrounds that work together, you know, to solve a problem, mm-hmm. they might even produce better results than the copied instance of multiple of one foundation model that maybe only trained on English data. So I think there are also practical reasons that you want to have a diversity there, you know, in the foundation models.
To improve the results, I think you make an excellent point on that. Antonio, you are in a research and an academic institution. I want to touch the topic of jobs. There have been, you know, there are two aspects to it. On one side, people say, you know, companies like OpenAI and others are paying like $1 million for highly skilled, some of your PhD students who are listening can probably get that kind of money. But then we have the World Economic Forum, McKinsey, IMF saying that 60% in developed countries, about 30 to 60% displacement of workforce could happen. Now, you are teaching students, which you have a sense of responsibility to these students, that you teach them, hopefully they get livelihood, etc. What are your thoughts? I mean, firstly, there is, you know, this talk that there is a scarcity of AI talent. Then there is this talk that there is going to be huge displacement. Talk to our listeners as a leader, a thought leader in research and academic as to what should they be thinking. Lawmakers here are trying to figure out, hey, 60% people will be without jobs. What can they do?
Yeah, I think, first of all, although I'm not an expert in labor market, of course, you know, I have to make this small disclaimer, but I have an opinion. Mm-hmm. I think I've seen this McKinsey report, for example. I think there is a slight, overestimation how quick actually AI will be integrated into our processes, you know. Mm-hmm. And there are many examples from former technological breakthroughs and the time it took actually to bring those breakthroughs really to full exploitation into society, into labor processes, so that I'm a little bit skeptical. I don't believe this will happen in a couple of years. I think the McKinsey report mentioned 2030 as a goal. Mm-hmm. I think it will take longer. This is my opinion. Nevertheless, I believe that many jobs will be affected by AI in the future. I don't think so much that many jobs will really disappear as in their job description. I think they will be transformed. But of course, productivity will be risen. And this also means you need less people for the same amount of work, you know. Mm-hmm. For many Western society, This is rather good news, in my opinion, because, as you mentioned, we are lacking actually talent, mm-hmm. and even worse, we are lacking young people in general. You know, we have a demographic catastrophe coming around the corner, at least Western country and also China. We know this. Also, China mm-hmm. has this problem. Mm-hmm. And, for example, in Germany, we are currently pressing to bring AI into administration because mm-hmm. many jobs in German administration the positions are open and they're mm-hmm. not able to find people, you know, to do this, you know. And so there is a big chance actually that we, and also in a way an obligation to exploit AI to its full potential, in particular in administration, to be able to maintain the service level within our societies also in 5 to 10 years, you know. So, but still, I think there will be, to a certain extent, changes in the labor market, also huge changes. They might mm-hmm. take a little bit longer than studies suggest, mm-hmm. but there will be an impact, in particular on white-collar workers, which have been more or less in the past not so much the target of large job changes and transformation.
So what you're saying is transformation will come, but maybe it'll be later than what most people are predicting because it'll take a little longer to get integrated. But what you're also, I think, very important point you're making is that this could be beneficial, especially to Western societies. Even Japan, look at the demographic challenges that they are facing, or like you said, China, where this could potentially help with some of the demographic challenges that are being faced. But jobs will get transformed, productivity will be raised. So those are excellent points. Antonio, for our listeners who are not as familiar with Germany, you know, people who are in the US or Asia, etc., we have a lot of listeners around the world. Give a brief idea of the AI ecosystem in Germany. I mean, we are familiar with Aleph Alpha and a bunch of other companies, but I'm sure there is a lot more to the German AI ecosystem besides some of these companies. So it would be really helpful to us, if not to them, but to me for sure.
Sure. Yeah, no. So as you might know, research on AI has a long tradition in Germany. Yep. And we have a couple of very excellent locations, you know, for basic academic research. In fact, actually, the German government has funded, besides DFKI, five so-called AI competence centers mm-hmm. that since a couple of years are basically get additional funding. There is around, and they are a little bit regionally distributed in Germany, mm-hmm. Around those centers, AI ecosystems have started to flourish, you know. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, I'm of course, we have the problem of investment money, venture capital in Europe in general. It's mm-hmm. getting a little bit better. We now managed to get the first rounds actually of also in Germany, but also France is very good actually. Mm-hmm. First rounds, investment rounds covered. When it comes to the large scaling rounds, we still mm-hmm. lag behind, you know, I mm-hmm. believe. But if you look at cities like Berlin, they have mm-hmm. a very vibrant AI ecosystem. If you look at cities like Munich, that mm-hmm. have around the Technical University of Munich, a very mm-hmm. good concept how to build up startups. And mm-hmm. also DFKI has a long tradition of developing startups. Mm-hmm. And actually, that's one of our also missions, you know, transfer missions, to allow our employees after a couple of years as DFKI researchers to take their knowledge and try their own luck in their own funded companies. I think this is very important. Wow. And this is something also special, I guess, in Germany that we have. I mentioned those small and medium-sized enterprises, you know, yeah. and lots of innovation happens in these companies in Germany. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, The challenge here is, other than the US, where everything is pretty public in a sense that, you know, there is an idea and then you have investors immediately and then ideas are scaled up quickly, you know. Mm-hmm. Often in Germany, innovation happened behind closed doors, you know. Mm-hmm. And even some companies in Germany, they don't even file patents because they're afraid that those ideas are then copied. So they rather have the advantage of the early mover, you know, for a certain while, you know, and they're not so much interested in patents. So it's interesting, you know, to see how this ecosystem now kind of adopts AI and AI technology. I think those are the peculiarities actually of the German and maybe also the European AI ecosystem.
But Antonio, from everything that I've read and I've talked to guests, the talent is tremendous in Germany, in France, I mean, all over Europe. In some cases, unfortunately, that the US has been the beneficiary of that talent, to be very frank with you. But with companies like Mistral, Aleph Alpha, and others, we are starting to see now whether, and I'm hoping that, that as you said, that funding ecosystem, et cetera, begins, because I think it's not just for the US, but I think for the rest of the world, we need many, many different pockets of AI excellence happening around the world, because absolutely, it is going to be very important to democratize that. And I wanted to ask you that question. Does that worry you? Because I know that I have a lot of senators, congressmen come in here, and one of the big worries for them is the monopoly of AI in a few companies, because right now we are struggling with the monopoly of social media with a few companies, and the last thing we want is the same thing to happen. Is that a concern for you or in Europe or anything like that?
I think there is a clear advantage at the moment, especially in the US, you know, regarding the technology. Mm-hmm. Not so much about how, you know, about the general architectures that are used. Those are basically well known and everybody mm-hmm. uses more or less the same. But of mm-hmm. course, in the engineering and in the doing, you know, mm-hmm. and how the data is handled, because the big American companies, they have this advantage that they were able actually to experiment on the data, you know, and build these models, you know, in the last couple of years. A head start. This would not have been even possible in Europe 1.5 years ago to build such a large language model, because of lacking in financial capabilities, but also because of lacking computational capabilities. Yeah, right. This is getting better now. I'm not so super pessimistic regarding the monopoly. And the main reason is that AI models are a piece of technology. They're not so much a platform service. It's not a platform economy, although of course, the large American companies try to integrate this into their platforms, you know. Mm. We see with Mistral, for example, the open source model, that you can do many things with that model already, you know. Mm. Of course, it has to be adapted to certain use cases, used with data from certain domains and so on. But and so I'm not so pessimistic there. I believe my feeling is that we have a trend that goes more into the direction that large AI models, foundational models, will be rather part of operating systems in the future, you know, then, and this means nobody is going to pay a lot for them in the end, you know, maybe the costs to operate them, those have to go down for sure, but it's not like that. There will be a monopoly of one technological provider or only a few. I think we will see much more foundation models coming now. We have now the enormous trend towards foundation models that include data from real-world interaction, you know, sensor information, robot interaction, and so on. Mm-hmm. We will see several models appear there. So I think there will be a variety of models. I rather believe that commercialization will take place in the applications, in the domain, and not so much at the technological core. But we will see.
Well, I'm glad that you're not worried, because I can tell you the lawmakers here are concerned because of what happened with social media.
Of course, I understand this. Yes.
Yeah. Antonio, I could talk to you for hours because I have so many other questions, but we'll need to get you back again here. But towards the end, we have a few lightning round questions. These are either or. In your case, we'll make an exception. It can be both. So we'll just ask you a few questions relating to that to get some idea of your thought process. So let's just go with the lightning round of questions. Antonio, would you like transparency or privacy?
So I think both is important.
Okay. National AI policies or international AI frameworks?
International AI frameworks.
Okay. Ethical AI boards or government regulation?
I tend more towards governmental regulations, but we also need the boards for sure.
Okay. Do you want algorithmic transparency or data transparency?
I think they're really difficult to tell. I think both are important, but I would tend more towards data transparency. But auditing algorithms might be also a viable way, actually.
That's a tough one. Antonio, is AI a greater risk or opportunity for society?
Opportunity, of course.
Wonderful. Should we tax AI companies more or provide them incentives?
So I think at the moment it's more incentives, actually.
Okay. Last one for you. Should we criminalize advanced deepfakes or counter them with authentication tech?
We need definitely both.
I agree with you. So, Antonio, for our audience, I mean, you've been just such an incredible guest. Tell them, looking ahead, what are your hopes and concerns for the future of AI? What role should regulation play in shaping that future, especially to our lawmakers, legislators here, to the European members of parliament who are listening?
Yeah, I very much hope that actually we will be able to deliver on the vision of human-centered AI, as we discussed today. I think we need rules and regulations to do so. But I also strongly believe that most of AI researchers and most of people who are in the AI business share this vision, you know. And of course, there are people that use AI as tools to do harm. And my big hope is actually that we will be able to mitigate actually those risks, and that that AI will help us actually to deliver on the promise of a more democratic and more human-centered use of technology. And I hope that we will do a better job actually than we did with social media, actually the internet. You know, this is actually the chance now.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Antonio, for sharing your valuable insights with us today. You know, your dedication to human-centered AI and your work at the intersection of AI and human-computer interaction are really inspiring. And as we navigate the complexities of AI regulation, your perspectives will undoubtedly help shape a more democratic, fair, and equitable future for AI technology. And to all our listeners, thank you for tuning in for this episode of Regulating AI. Stay tuned for more conversations with leading experts and lawmakers as we continue to explore the critical issues surrounding AI regulation. Until next time, stay informed and engaged. Thank you so much, Antonio. This was fabulous. As I said, we need to get you back because I had so many questions that I needed to ask.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Thank you.